Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Linda Meyerholtz.
And it's good to have you here as a co-host again for the show today, Linda.
I so much enjoy doing this show.
Well, we have got some really fascinating things that we're going to talk about on the show today, including a recent conversation I've had with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Coven, internist and writer in residence at Massachusetts General Hospital, about time, the doctor's new dilemma. And I bet it's a dilemma not just for doctors, but for all professionals.
Absolutely. We're trying to do so much in less time and trying to be more productive, and we've got to figure out how to make that work.
But first, we're going to actually be able to also talk about research that matters in this segment of the show. We're going to be able to talk about pre-pregnancy caffeine consumption and miscarriage risk.
We're also going to be talking about diabetes, not just in the United States, but actually worldwide and what's happening with that.
We're going to be talking about something I know is near and dear to you. It's about depression symptoms and perhaps treatment and avoiding cardiovascular bad disease outcomes.
And then also, again, we're going to be touching base on the Zika virus. It's something that's been in the media a lot, and it's raising a lot of good research.
Well, let's dive right in there. And let's first talk about pregnancy and caffeine consumption. And this is some really interesting research that was published in a journal called Fertility and Sterility.
Absolutely. This was a really interesting study that was done at Ohio State. And they looked longitudinally at 501 couples to see what factors may have influenced the chance that they were going to have a miscarriage.
Yeah, they looked at things like cigarette use. Did they have caffeinated beverages before of the pregnancy and during the pregnancy, and whether they used a multivitamin. And they were looking at the weeks before they conceived through the seventh week of pregnancy and found some pretty startling findings.
Yeah, what I thought was very interesting is when they looked at the partners, if both women, and this was true for the men as well, if they drank more than two caffeinated beverages per day in the weeks leading up to conception, there was a higher chance of miscarriage.
Right. They call it a hazard ratio, which is kind of like a risk. And it wasn't quite twofold, but that's a pretty significant elevated risk that they had. And considering that 28% of all the pregnancies ended in miscarriage, this is not like a small event. And the caffeinated beverages is something that, well, one can choose to go without, clearly. And this was something that was important not only during the pregnancy, but before the pregnancy.
So before the pregnancy, the suggestion would be to minimize caffeine use if you're trying to get pregnant. And then in that early conception area.
The other thing they could do was to take a multivitamin, because that appeared to be a protective effect. It's like, oh, these are such simple things. Let me avoid my caffeine and take a multivitamin.
Right. Things that parents can definitely do to potentially help improve the chances of a healthy pregnancy.
Yeah, it was almost a 50% reduction in miscarriage risk with the daily multivitamin. So hopefully this is research. If you have a loved one or a family member or you yourself are trying to get pregnant, this could lower your risk.
Absolutely.
Talk about lowering risk. The next research that matters is a little bit depressing because this is the risk of diabetes around the world.
They were really looking at worldwide what is happening with the rate of diabetes. And they're really finding that it's fast growing, particularly in countries that are the low or middle income countries.
Yeah, it increased worldwide since 1980 to 2014 from 108 million to 422 million. And it's more common now than so many other things in the world. And it's doubled among men from 4.3% to 9% and two-thirds among women from 5% to 8%. And as you said, the greatest increases are occurring in like five countries, China, India, United States, Brazil, and Indonesia. Half of all adults with diabetes live in those countries.
Yeah, and they really are linking again back to obesity as being an important risk factor for the development of the type 2 diabetes and really needing to make efforts to control obesity in a variety of different countries may be where we need to put our energies.
Yeah, no country saw a significant decrease in diabetes. I'm hoping, Linda, that in my professional lifetime, you know, I'm committed to helping our patients, and I'm hoping my colleagues do the exact same in this ripple effect to lose weight and that we can see a reduction in diabetes prevalence. I don't know, we're the first country that's going to see it, but I'm hoping maybe we could be one of the first.
It would be something to be very proud of if we can achieve that.
The next one, something that we might be able to be proud of, is something I know near and dear to you, but it is the association between depression and major cardiovascular problems like stroke, heart failure, heart attacks, and death.
Yeah, there's been a lot of research that has shown us that there's a relationship between depression and cardiovascular risk. And this study really looked at a group of patients who did not have depression previously. They looked at measuring depression at one point and then looking ahead at cardiovascular events. And what they really found is that those folks who did have depression and were treated, or their depression at least reduced on their measure, had better outcomes in terms of their cardiovascular health risks.
Yeah, it was really amazing. They followed, there's a database of over 100,000 patients, and they looked at this subset of 8,000 who had completed these two different depression questionnaires over a couple years. And what was really striking is if you had depression, we know that all those bad outcomes that you talked about, that they're really there. We know that you have to intervene when someone is depressed. But 2 years later, if they were no longer depressed, they had the heart outcomes like someone who had never been depressed. And that's really tells us, maybe depression treatment works. I bet that's not like lightning revelations to our head of our behavioral medicine curriculum.
Absolutely. But it also does highlight the real critical importance of screening for depression. And if you're not certain about what are signs and symptoms of depression, that would be a great question to ask your doctor.
Yeah. And let's just put up a very short resource on our website from our health sciences librarians. We'll ask them to put up a little short resource on signs and symptoms of depression.
Great.
Easily to treat. Compared to easy to treat, the next research is perhaps not surprising, but it's around the Zika virus. And we know that this has kind of gripped the public imagination. And this is some research about what does the American public understand about the Zika virus?
Now, this was really interesting because what they found is that while many Americans had heard about the Zika virus, 4 in 10 Americans had heard only little or nothing, according to their own report. And this was done by interviewing a random sample of Americans through a group called Amerispeak.
They also found that only 57% were aware of this group who had heard about it, that it could be spread through sexual intercourse with an infected person. Now, at some levels, I think this is amazing. The fact that 57% of Americans who are aware of the Zika virus already know this suggests that these public health campaigns are starting to spread information. Because I wanted to know how many people know about sexual spread of things like herpes or sexual spread of things through syphilis or other things that have been around and we've known about for 1,000 years and affect thousands of Americans. So I was a little bit kind of heartened by this, though I think the researchers were like, whoa, we need to do a lot more education here.
Yeah, that was definitely their conclusion. But I think you have a very good perspective there because unfortunately we have a lot of diseases that Americans aren't as familiar with.
Right. So I think we need to increase the attention to Zika virus, but I think also attending to what are the things that are really killing people as of today. We shouldn't forget about that as well. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had a chance to not only talk about Zika virus, but we've been able to talk about kind of reducing depression and lowering cardiovascular risk.
We've talked about diabetes and the impact worldwide that it's having on our health. And we also talked about ways to help improve the likelihood of a healthy pregnancy through reducing caffeine and taking a multivitamin.
Good research. And that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Suzanne Coven, internist and writer in residence at Massachusetts General Hospital, about time, the doctor's new dilemma. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Linda Meyerholtz. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's #2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. And today on Conversations, I have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Suzanne Coven, internist and writer in residence at Massachusetts General Hospital, about time, the doctor's new dilemma. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Coven.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, it's really our pleasure. And I must say that over the years, one of the real purposes of Your Health is to really bring stories to our listeners around the country. And you have really interesting stories. And I guess one of the first ones that we would love to find out a little bit more about is, first off, how did you decide to become a physician? And when did you start writing?
Well, my dad was a doctor. He was an orthopedic surgeon. And so I always thought I might want to follow in his footsteps. I was the kind of kid who used to go to his office and develop x-rays back in the days when, you know, that involved dipping them into the big vats of chemicals and so forth. But I wasn't particularly good at science or interested in science. And so I thought it just wasn't meant to be for me. I was an English major in college. And then after I graduated, I revisited the idea of being a doctor and went back and took all of the prerequisites. And then I have to say I thought that the writing would be on the back burner, something maybe I would do in an extracurricular sort of way once my kids got older. But as it turned out, the writing career and the medical career have very much fused at this point.
That's really interesting. I started out to be an English major up at Tufts, but I didn't think I could write well enough to make a living. So I'm always fascinated of these dual careers. We're going to talk in a few minutes about this essay that you wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine. But you say in one of your public biographies that storytelling is where medicine is. What do you mean by that statement?
I guess what a quarter century of clinical experience at this point has told me is that there just is no tool we have that's more valuable than hearing a person's story, not just in terms of establishing rapport with that person or making them feel heard and understood, though those are extremely important things, but just diagnostically, therapeutically, listening to the basic elements of the story, the sequence of events as the patient presents them. Those are really important. It sounds like such a very basic thing, but if you shortcut that storytelling process, I think you very often end up missing the diagnosis or ordering unnecessary tests with the idea that there's just not enough time to sort of hear all that, except the hearing of all of that, I think, really is where a lot of the diagnosis and therapy comes.
This element of time is such a critical and important one. And it sounds like that you advocate at the beginning of a medical encounter with the patient, this open-ended question almost of, tell me what's going on in your life. And something that's very open-ended where it seems as if a lot of the training for students and residents would be much more directed. Is that correct?
You know, tell me what's going on in your life is something that I say to patients I know well who are coming in for their annual physical. But what I might say to somebody coming in for an acute problem, and I would say particularly if it's somebody I don't know, what I always start out by saying is, tell me the whole story from the beginning. Now that, as I've said elsewhere, that may make some of my colleagues gasp because it sounds like, oh, gee, you know, you'll be in there forever. But I find it actually saves me a lot of time. And I also find it tremendously revealing where a person chooses to begin the story. An example I often give is a sore throat. Somebody may tell me that their throat felt scratchy yesterday and their kid has strep throat, and that's the beginning of the story. Someone else may say, I've been sick all winter. And the third person may say, you know, my immune system's been weak my whole life. So the context in which that symptom is occurring, the meaning that the patient places on the symptom, I think, is very much expressed in where they begin the story itself. So I always ask, you know, begin at the beginning.
How do you handle then this really almost overwhelming sense of time that clinicians have, where an average patient maybe get 15, maybe 20 minutes if they're lucky? And so if you give more time to one patient, there's a finite amount of time in the day that's less to someone else, or people wait. How do you handle that when you have a complicated discussion in patient?
Well, I think, first of all, your question presupposes that letting the patient tell their story takes more time than not letting them tell their story. And I challenge that idea. I find I had a very complicated patient that I saw the other day, someone I had never met before. And I said to her, tell me the whole story of your life from the beginning. And within about 5 or 10 minutes, I really had the whole picture. Whereas if I had tried to sort of control what she told me, I think I would have gotten a very incomplete story, and I'm not sure I would have saved myself any time. But having said that, it would be disingenuous of me to pretend that the question you're asking about time isn't one that I think about every day. We don't have enough time with our patients. And to be quite honest, what I do is I shortcut the things that are less important to me in the room. For example, I never type in front of patients, so I end up running late, and I end up staying late sometimes. And this is a trade-off because, as you quite rightly say, you only have just so many minutes. But I feel, for me, that if I start typing while a patient's talking, I've lost the meaning of what I'm doing. Not everybody feels that way, and I respect that. But I've lost the meaning of what I'm doing, and then why would I do it? It's just something I resist. I just can't go there.
Well, I know your patients really appreciate that, because we know the converse is how difficult it is, and patients don't really like when their physicians are typing and not looking and engaging. And we're going to talk, after we take a break, about a lot of the issues that you raise about how this type of narrative that you're really telling us about really does maybe lead to better care and outcomes, and how then you can avoid kind of burnout and those issues. But I wonder if you can just go back real quickly to that patient you mentioned that you've known for a while, and it is a tell me how you're doing. Some people might see that as chit-chat. What are the economics of chit-chat? Are there costs and benefits to having that type of discussion?
Well, I don't see any costs. I think the benefits are great. Medicine is fundamentally about human relationships. And expressing interest in the things that are important to someone establishes bond, establishes relationship, and that can only be good for, you know, the therapeutic enterprise. I think you also find things out that you might not have found out. For example, someone comes in for an annual physical, nothing particular is wrong with them in that they don't have any new complaints, and they've had their lab work done, and that all checks out, and their mammogram's up to date, and so forth. But you say, how are things going with you? And immediately someone reaches for the Kleenex, and they start talking about some terrible trouble that they're having with their kids. You know, if that's not part of what medicine's about, of what the doctor's role is in primary care, then I don't know what is. And you could miss that if you don't ask.
Well, and that has true benefits for patients. And this conversation, I think, is having benefit for our listeners. But we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Suzanne Coben, internist and writer in residence at Massachusetts General Hospital, about time, the doctor's new dilemma. We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info.
working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we've been talking with Dr. Suzanne Coven, internist and writer-in-residence at the Division of General Internal Medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital, about time, the doctor's new dilemma. And Dr. Coven, you did write this New England Journal of Medicine perspective about this topic. Could you share with us a little bit about what made you write that, and tell us what the narrative that you were talking about in the story? It's very poignant.
Almost everything that I write starts with a moment of discomfort, a moment when I feel something that I don't really understand, and I write to try to understand it better. What happened in this instance was that I was seeing a patient, a young woman, who had diarrhea, and she had it intermittently, and it didn't sound particularly serious, and yet she looked like she was about to start sobbing as she was describing it. And what I say in the piece is that a psychiatric colleague once told me that if there's a mismatch between the content and the affect, that that's a really sort of ripe moment for probing. And on the one hand, I wanted to ask her, you know, why are you so emotionally distraught about this? But on the other hand, I knew that if I did ask her, then we wouldn't be talking just about her diarrhea anymore. We might be talking about something more, and that that conversation might take much longer, and that I might fall hopelessly behind. And I started thinking about this kind of precipice that we often find ourselves in. And since the piece came out, I should tell you, it's really quite amazing. It's been viewed something crazy like, you know, 138,000 times, and I've been getting emails about it from all over the world and from clinicians at all stages of their careers. There's something very familiar to people about that moment where you're faced with a dilemma. If you open the door to the more intimate interaction, you fall behind and you feel more burnt out. But if you don't open the door and you don't have that more intimate interaction with a patient, then you risk losing a chance to help them. And you also pull away from the very kind of interaction that made you go into medicine in the first place. So it's a real, it's sort of like a catch-22, and it's something that's been an ongoing source of tremendous concern and frustration to me.
Well, you talk about the nature of primary care, which takes someone who likes to talk with people and it puts mm-hmm. them behind the door with this very intense situation that can have tons of emotion. But then you talk about how when one leaves that environment, the healthcare professional may be on their own and can't talk with colleagues so easily, and to keep these mm-hmm. thoughts and emotions pent up. How do you avoid the potential stress and burnout that may come? And I guess for you, maybe it's writing. Is that mm-hmm. what others should do?
Well, I wouldn't presume to say others should write. There are all sorts of other wonderful outlets. But I think first of all, we have to acknowledge that there is something a bit paradoxical about taking medical school applicants who are being praised for their people skills and then kind of isolating them and not letting them express these skills to the full extent that perhaps they could. So that's one thing. But I think once people are in practice, you know, there are all sorts of ways to address that sense of isolation. In my own hospital, something that I do that I find tremendously rewarding in that regard is I run a monthly literature discussion group for doctors, nurses, social workers, hospital administrators, and many people who have participated in that program have said that it's a really great antidote to healthcare workers' stress and burnout.
And so you frequently write about this interplay between two possible different outcomes happening. Are there other examples you are sometimes faced with? One was obviously asking the question that pushes you further. What other choices do you as a physician face when you're faced between two possibilities?
Well, I'm not arguing for 100% transparency and revelation on the part of the clinician, and that the clinician needs to reveal his or her every thought, because sometimes, you know, that's not helpful for the patient, and what's helpful for the patient is really the, you know, the bottom line. I'm actually talking about, and I'm not really even talking about revelation at all. I'm talking about something really quite specific, which has to do with, if you will, inviting conversation with the patient. Now, in the New England Journal piece, I bring up some much less dramatic examples than the one with the woman, you know, who's on the verge of tears about her diarrhea, maybe. Which is, say you walk, I mean, anybody who practices medicine has had this experience. You walk into an exam room, the patient's waiting for you reading a book. You have read that book. You have thoughts about that book. And there's that moment where you think, do I ignore the fact that she's reading the book? Because then I don't have to deal with that and I don't have to take up time, you know, to have that chit chat. Or do I say, oh, I see you're reading that. I read it too. Did you enjoy it? That's what I'm talking about. What are the risks and benefits of opening that door between us?
So let me ask you a question, maybe our last question. What would you recommend to other doctors, residents, as you hear from them around the country? What do you recommend to them to how to navigate what increasingly can be a difficult landscape with meaningful use and all of the things that doctors have to do and boxes to check off and electronic health records? And then what do you recommend to patients who maybe understand what you're saying, maybe even more intuitively than doctors?
Well, to doctors, I would say two things. One is something we were talking about before, which is don't assume that engaging patients is more time-consuming than not engaging them. Because, in fact, I can give you many examples where inviting patients to tell their story more fully actually saved time and certainly saved testing, saved a lot of wear and tear for everybody involved. So don't assume that engagement always is time-consuming or more time-consuming. But the other thing is I would say, you know, push back on this notion that having the computer between us and the patient is inevitable. Push back on the notion that having shorter and shorter visits is inevitable. You know, I think that we have the power to resist that. As far as patients go, I think that patients have the right to demand our engagement and our attention. I'll tell you about a situation in which the tables were turned. I went to see a colleague of mine for a symptom. The colleague was just beginning to experiment with voice recognition documentation and was wearing a headset and dictating while I was on the exam table. And he was had the headset on. He was dictating and editing on the computer screen. And I was becoming more and more anxious. And at one point, I finally said, listen, this is very distracting. I can't talk to you if you're talking into a headset and typing. I just can't. And he said, oh, once we get this part out of the way, then the real doctoring will begin.
Oi.
And I said, it it will be too late then, because you will have lost my trust. And he had. There is, you know, maybe I'm a particularly sensitive patient, but, you know, it's a very delicate thing to go and tell a stranger about your intimate, you know, bodily experiences and fears, and to be told that, you know, when it's convenient for me to get this out of the way, I will take the headset off and I will actually look at you. It's too late by then. And I think, you know, more patients should say what I said, which is, I can't be your patient if you're going to interact with me that way.
Well, I think we should rename our show called Time, It's Not Too Late, because if you wait too long to do the sort of empowerment for doctors and patients that you recommend, if you wait too long, then trust could be lost. So we really need to thank you for sharing your stories and your passion with our listeners.
It's been my pleasure.
We've been talking with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Coven, internist and writer in residence in the Division of General Internal Medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital, about the doctor's new dilemma. We're going to take a short break, but coming up, we'll be listening to questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segments of our show today, Linda and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have some questions you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please just send us your comments. You can send them to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first house call question about smoking, I think.
I'm 35 years old, and I've been smoking since I was 15. I want to quit, but I know that quitting is very, very difficult. Do you have any recommendations based on research or your personal experience on the best ways to quit? And if I can quit, are there health things that I need to keep an eye on down the road because of the time that I spent smoking?
Well, I can say if you want to quit, you could do what I did, which is get on a bicycle, go up into the Swiss Alps and start biking for 7 weeks. I can tell you after about the second or third day, you will not be smoking anymore.
Okay.
You won't be able to breathe.
Adam, can we have some other tips that might be more applicable?
Applicable, yes. Well, you know, at our nicotine dependence program, and we'll put a link to that on our website, we really help people understand that it's not easy to quit, but yet people can quit successfully. And combining behavioral support,
yes,
and you can talk about that, Linda, with pharmacologic support actually is the best way. And it takes some people several times to quit, but the best answer is to start it now. Any behavioral tips that you like, Linda?
Well, the first thing is that you've got some motivation to quit, which is fabulous. Some other strategies to help yourself get ready: start to tell people that you trust that you want to quit and let them know how they can support you. Get rid of all the cigarettes everywhere they're hidden, in your car, your workplace, in your home, so that it makes it much more difficult when you're having those cravings to reach for the cigarette. And then really start to plan for how to manage those cravings. Think about those high-risk times that you're likely to want to smoke and develop a plan. Who am I going to talk to? What am I going to do to get myself busy? What can I do to ride through that craving?
And so talk with your primary care physician, talk with a therapist, see us at the Nicotine Dependence Program if you are a local, or go to a tobacco treatment specialist in your own community. All good ways to get support. Increases your chance of being successful. Thanks so much for a great question. Daniel, what's our very next house call?
I just moved halfway across the country to start a new job. I'm very excited about it, but the trouble is now every time I want to visit my family, I'm going to have to fly, and I'm terrified of flying. It seems a bit silly to see a doctor about this, but is there anything they could do to help me out with this?
Well, I would see someone who maybe specializes in figuring out why things like this you're feeling. What do you think, Linda? You got anyone in mind?
Yes, absolutely. You know, fear of flying is one of the more common kinds of phobias that are out there. Other common phobias are fears of elevators, small spaces. Mine is a spider. You know, so very common for people to have phobias. But we do know that there's some real strategies that a behavioral health professional can help you with if you want to learn to manage the anxiety in an effective way so that it doesn't impact your life in a negative way.
And I know that some of my patients, particularly since 9/11, have had some increased fear of flying that's associated with some of those experiences and perhaps having had relatives in New York or family. And so sometimes there's a little bit of even post-traumatic stress that kind of precipitated in flying, and there's some good strategies to help with that. Occasionally, medication may be part of the ways as well. So we encourage you to talk with someone and get some help, but you are not alone. This is a great question. Yeah. Thanks so much. Daniel, what's our next house call?
I recently switched to a vegetarian diet. I have a history of mild anemia, and my doctor has given me ferrous sulfate in the past, but I'd rather get my nutrients from my diet than from supplements. Do you know of any good vegetarian options that are particularly iron-rich?
Well, this is a question that the listener probably didn't know that's coming to a fellow vegetarian here, so I appreciate that question. And a lot of times people wonder, can they get all of their nutrients from being vegetarian? The short answer is yes. The great news is that a lot of the things in a vegetarian diet are really rich in iron, things like a lot of your whole grains, a lot of your deep green leafy vegetables, even tomatoes, all great sources of iron.
Wow. And Adam, you shared something today that I'd never realized, that you shared that cooking in an iron skillet is another way that we can increase the iron content in our foods.
Yeah, you can put those onions and marinate them in a little bit of olive oil and garlic in the iron skillet, and those onions just start absorbing some of that iron. So lots of ways of getting iron naturally, which I think is a great suggestion, and probably not going to be quite as constipating as that iron sulfate, which can be really constipating. A lot of people don't like that. Thanks for the question. Daniel, what's our very last house call?
My dog recently got into a little fight with another dog at the park, and while I was trying to pull my dog away, the other dog bit my hand. It was a complete accident, but I was wondering if there was anything I needed to do about the bite. I know if a wild animal bit me, I would talk to my doctor about rabies, but this is somebody's dog who's supposedly up on its shots. Do I need to do anything special?
Well, that's kind of scary. You know, when dogs get into dog fights, and even cats, probably cat fights, I'm not certain because I don't have as much exposure to cats, but it can be scary, and trying to separate them can be dangerous, and so it doesn't surprise me that you got a bite, and that sometimes can be really bad. I don't know if you've ever been bitten by an animal, Linda, but I've had a dog bite, and those small animals, sometimes even large ones, those teeth can go right into the hands and where tendons are, and that can be actually sometimes really quite serious.
Yeah, so what would you recommend in that situation?
Well, first I'd recommend you get looked at, particularly because the bites can be worse than they seem, and infections on the hand can spread really quickly. So getting them irrigated really well and really quickly to get rid of as much bacteria as you can, and perhaps needing to be on some antibiotics might be good. I do think getting the dog and making sure that they are up to date on their shots would be important. You might need a tetanus shot. And then I think that there's, you know, it said it's an accident, but I remember one of my great mentors said there's really no accidents or injuries, and injuries are preventable. Sometimes accidents you think aren't preventable, and I wonder if this wouldn't be a little bit of some red flags of what you could do next time to prevent being in a situation where you're needing to separate dogs that are fighting.
Yeah, so it's really not just about rabies. There's other things to consider as well.
Yeah, I think, matter of fact, the more serious things, infections are far more common than things like rabies. Great. Well, that'll conclude our house calls for today. And we've had some great chance to talk about some things that hopefully are important to people's health. And we want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in today and listening to Your Health. If you have things that you would like us to talk about on an upcoming show, email us at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. And we would like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Suzanne Coven, and our guest co-host, Dr. Linda Meyerholtz.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Linda Meyerholtz.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Please join us again. Thank you.
Thank you.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.